All right, so get this. Even Darwin and Wallace, the guys who basically cracked the code on evolution, they didn't actually know the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of how W traits were passed down.
Yeah, they knew it happened, obviously, but the how, that was a complete mystery back then.
It's kind of like knowing, say, a cake exists, but having absolutely zero clue about the recipe, right?
Exactly. And it gets even more interesting, actually. Back then, the big idea in the room was this thing called orthogenesis.
Orthogenesis.
Yeah, basically the idea that evolution had a set path. Like, it wasn't random at all. There was this invisible hand guiding all these different species towards some kind of predetermined goal.
Wow, so it wasn't just like a blank slate for them. They had this whole predetermined evolution storyline going on.
Yeah, and it gets even wilder. So you've got Gregor Mendel, right? This meticulous monk hanging out with his pea plants
Right, the pea guy.
and his work. Revolutionary. Totally groundbreaking stuff. But for some reason, it just didn't catch on right away.
Huh, that's rough. Imagine discovering something amazing and everyone's just like, meh, whatever. But why the cold shoulder for Mendel's pea discoveries?
Well, Mendel was laser focused on these super clear-cut traits in
Yeah.
his peas. What we call dichotomous traits, smooth pea versus wrinkled pea, you know, no in between.
Yeah.
But in the real world, in nature, things are almost always way more complicated than that.
Right. It's not like you're either totally lactose intolerant or you're like chugging milk by the gallon. There's a whole range in between.
Exactly. Most traits are influenced by tons of genes, and they're all interacting in these crazy complex ways.
Oh.
And get this, Gore Mendel also tried to replicate his pea experiments with hawkweed.
Hawkweed. I was.
But hawkweed reproduces asexually.
Oh no, talk about backing the wrong horse. Or should I say, plant.
Right.
So while Mendel's work was on hold, what were other scientists up to? What were they looking at?
They were getting busy with their microscopes.
Okay.
And that's where things start to get really interesting. They discover this little thing called the cell nucleus.
The nucleus. Okay, yeah, I remember that from biology class. But how did they figure out it was connected to inheritance?
Imagine being a scientist back then. Peering down a rudimentary microscope at these tiny cells, they find this really prominent structure, the nucleus, inside the cell, and they start to suspect it might hold the key to inheritance.
It's like finding a treasure chest. You just know there's got to be something important inside.
Exactly. It's like the VIP lounge of the cell.
Right.
And speaking of VIPs, it's actually quite a fascinating historical tidbit that Robert Brown, the guy who discovered the nucleus, is also the Brown behind Brownian motion.
Really?
Yeah, you might have heard it in physics. It's that random movement of particles in a fluid.
Whoa, two major discoveries by the same guy. Talk about an overachiever.
Right, science is full of these little unexpected connections, isn't it? But getting back to the nucleus, how did they go from, this thing looks important, to, aha, this is the control center of inheritance?
Yeah, it's not like the nucleus came with a little label saying, heredity headquarters.
It's exactly. Enter the amazing world of chromosomes. So scientists started seeing these thread-like structures appearing during cell division, and that really got them thinking about the nucleus's role in inheritance.
It's like those time-lapse videos you see where the chromosomes all line up and divide, mesmerizing.
Exactly. Then you've got this guy, Edouard van Beneden, and he was painstakingly counting those chromosomes in different species.
Oh, wow.
And this is where it gets really mind-boggling. So, do you think more complex organisms have more chromosomes?
That's a good question. More complexity, more instructions needed. I'm going to say yes.
That's a totally reasonable guess. But here's the twist. Chromosome number doesn't actually perfectly line up with how complex an organism is.
Really?
Yeah. For example, some ferns have hundreds of chromosomes, while humans have 46.
Wow, nature throwing us a curveball yet again. It's a good reminder that things aren't always as straightforward as they seem.
Absolutely. And just when they're wrapping their heads around chromosomes, another brilliant mind makes a critical connection. Walter Sutton links these chromosomes to Mendel's factors, what we now call genes.
So it's all coming together. Genes on chromosomes, chromosomes in the nucleus. But how did they figure out that DNA was the specific molecule carrying these genes?
Well, to get to the bottom of that, we have to go all the way back to the 1800s to to a slightly less glamorous side of science. We're talking about a time when scientists turned to, wait for it, sperm and pus.
Sperm and pus. Ew, okay, you definitely have my attention now.
I know, right? Not exactly dinner table conversations. But back then, they figured that these materials, the sperm and the pod, they'd be packed with those nuclear components. And you know, at the time, those were believed to hold all the secrets of inheritance.
Yeah, it makes sense in a really roundabout way, I guess. So what did they find in this potent cocktail of science?
Well, surprisingly, it actually led to a major breakthrough. A scientist named Friedrich Miescher.
Miescher, okay.
He used this, shall we say, unconventional approach to isolate this phosphorus-rich compound that he called nuclein.
Nuclein.
Yeah, and we know now that that nuclein, it actually contained both DNA and proteins.
Wow. So from pus to scientific progress. Gotta admire those early scientists and their dedication to discovery, even if their methods were a little...
Yeah, yeah.
But this is still just the tip of the iceberg, right? We haven't even gotten to DNA's big debut.
Oh, we're getting there.
Yeah.
But first, we need to talk about giant algae.
Giant algae. Okay, now you're just messing with me every time.
I'm serious. This wasn't just any pond scum. We're talking about a tabularia,
no.
Also known as the mermaid's wine glass. It's a single-celled algae, but get this. It can grow to be centimeters long.
Hold on, centimeters? A single cell that big? That's practically visible to the naked eye.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's what made it so perfect for this next experiment. A scientist named Joachim Hammerling, he used Acetabularia to essentially perform, get this, surgery on these giant cells.
Algae surgery. Now, this is my kind of science.
So picture this, right? These algae have distinct stalks and caps, kind of like a mushroom. And Hammerling, he figured out how to surgically remove and swap those parts between different species of Acetabularia with different cap shapes.
Okay, I can picture it. Tiny scalpels, a microscope, maybe some mini tweezers. So what happened? Did these, like, Frankenstein algae survive the procedure?
Not only did they survive, but the results were groundbreaking. Hammerling discovered that when he grafted the stalk of one species onto the base of another, so the base that contained the nucleus, the new cap that grew, always matched the nucleus, not the stalk.
Whoa, are you telling me that even though he swapped these, like, big chunks of algae, it was the nucleus calling the shots on how that cap developed?
Precisely. And this experiment was a game changer because, for the first time, scientists could actually see where the instructions for inheritance were coming from the nucleus.
Mind blown.
So we've gone from suspecting the nucleus to, like, really confirming it's the control center, but we still haven't nailed down DNA as the main player, right? How did scientists go from pointing the finger at the nucleus to zeroing in on DNA as the molecule of heredity?
Okay, get ready for a plot twist. This next chapter, it takes us back to bacteria, but with a bit of a spooky twist. Enter Fred Griffith and his pneumonia-causing bacteria.
Bacteria again. All right, lay it on me. What was so special about Griffith's bacteria?
Well, Griffith was working with two strains of Streptococcus pneumonia.
Okay.
One that caused pneumonia, we'll call it the smooth or S strain, and one that was harmless, the rough or R strain.
Right.
He injected these bacteria into mice to see what would happen.
Okay. Already feeling a little bit bad for these mice.
Sadly, the mice injected with the live S strain, they died.
Right.
But here's where it gets really interesting. Griffith found that if he heated the S strain bacteria, so killing them, and then injected them into mice, the mice lived.
That makes sense. Dead bacteria, no infection. But then Griffith did something unexpected. He mixed heat-killed S-strain bacteria, the dead but previously dangerous ones, with live R-strain bacteria, the harmless ones. And you know what? When he injected this cocktail into mice...
Don't tell me the mice died.
They did. And when he looked at samples from the dead mice, he found live S-strain bacteria, the deadly kind.
Wait a minute. Are you saying that something from those dead bacteria actually transformed the harmless ones into the deadly kind? That's incredible and a little creepy.
It is. Griffith called this mysterious something the transforming principle. He didn't know what it was, but he knew it could be passed down from the dead S-strain to the live R-strain. Like some kind of inheritable secret handshake.
So it's like those dead bacteria passed on a secret message saying, here's how to be lethal. That's wild.
It is wild. And tragically, Griffith didn't get to unravel this mystery himself. He died during a bombing raid in World War II.
Oh, wow. What a loss. So even in the midst of such darkness, the pursuit of scientific knowledge continued. But someone else picked up where Griffith left off, right?
They did, yeah. Three scientists, in fact. Oswald Avery, Colin McLeod, and Micklin McCarty. And they were, like... determined to figure out the identity of this mysterious transforming principle once and for all.
Yeah, I can only imagine the excitement and maybe a little bit of head scratching trying to like pick apart this invisible, deadly puzzle piece, how did they even begin to approach something like that?
Well, they were incredibly methodical about it. Imagine, like, this scientific dream team huddled over their lab benches, just meticulously separating out the different components of those deadly S-strain bacteria. The proteins, lipids, RNA, DNA, everything they could get their hands on, basically.
Well, they're treating each of these components as, like, a suspect in a molecular lineup.
Exactly. And here's where their genius really shines. They used enzymes, like these tiny molecular scissors, to destroy each component one by one.
Oh, wow.
Destroy the proteins, see if the transforming principle still works. Destroy the lipids, same thing. They systematically eliminated each suspect.
Talk about a high-stakes game of Clue. So what happened? Did they finally unmask the culprit?
They did. One by one, they knocked out proteins, lipids, RNA, and, you know, the transforming principle was still there, lurking in those bacterial extracts.
Right.
But when they destroyed the DNA...
What happened?
Case closed. No more transformation. Those harmless R-strain bacteria, they stayed harmless.
DNA, the smoking gun. It's amazing to think about how much information we just take for granted today, and it all kind of stems from this one elegant experiment. So they proved it was DNA, but there was still a huge piece of the puzzle missing, right? Like, if DNA was carrying all these genetic secrets, there had to be some way to actually copy that information and pass it on.
You're absolutely right. And this is where we get to one of the most, if not the most, iconic discoveries in all of science, the structure of DNA.
This is the moment of truth. What did they find?
Okay, so picture this. It's 1953. We've got Erwin Chargaff on the scene, brilliant biochemist, and he notices something really peculiar about DNA. He finds that the amount of adenine A, it always matches up with the amount of thymine T. And the amount of guanine G, it always matches up with cytosine C. And this is regardless of what organism he looks at.
So A's paired with T's and G's with C's. Was this just a curious coincidence, or did it, like, point to something deeper about DNA's structure?
Oh, it was a huge E clue.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, we've got Rosalind Franklin hard at work using this technique called X-ray diffraction, basically taking pictures of DNA.
Right.
Her images showed this kind of blurry X-shaped pattern.
I've seen those images. They look like a shadowy spiral staircase almost, like too perfect to be just a molecule.
Exactly. And then two, shall we say, brilliant minds, James Watson and Francis Crick, they stepped onto the scene, took Chargaff's clues, they took Franklin's X-ray data, added a whole lot of brain power, and they finally cracked the code, revealing DNA's, you know, it iconic double helix structure to the world.
The double helix, I mean, it's become a symbol of life itself. But what makes this structure so special, so elegant?
It's a masterpiece of form and function. Imagine like a twisted ladder. The rungs of this ladder, they're made of those base pairs we were talking about.
Mm.
The A pairing with T and the G with the C held together by hydrogen bonds.
Ah, so that's why those base pairs always match up. They're literally physically designed to fit together.
Exactly.
Right.
And the sides of the ladder, they're made of sugar and phosphate molecules, and they form this strong backbone for this very elegant, very twisted structure.
So DNA's structure is not only beautiful, but it also, like, protects that precious genetic information tucked away inside. It's like this protective spiral staircase for your genes.
I like that. I like that.
But how does this structure actually help with DNA replication, you know, with actually making copies of itself?
That's the truly amazing part. When it's time to replicate the DNA molecule, it unzips those hydrogen bonds between the base pairs. Just imagine, like, unzipping a zipper.
Right.
Each strand then serves as a template to build a new complementary strand. The A's pair up with the T's, the G's with the C's, and voila, two identical DNA molecules ready to pass on those genetic instructions.
It's like a molecular copy machine just cranking out genetic blueprints.
Precisely. And this double helix structure, it so elegantly solves the problem of inheritance, ensuring that genetic information can be accurately copied and passed down, you know, from generation to generation.
This has been an incredible journey. We've gone from, like, monks pondering peas to scientists dissecting giant algae and then ultimately, like, uncovering the secrets of DNA's structure. It's just amazing how much we've learned about the very building blocks of life. Any final thoughts for our listeners before we wrap things up?
Here's something to ponder. We've talked about how DNA stores information like a blueprint, but did you know that a surprisingly large chunk of our DNA doesn't actually seem to code for anything at all?
Really?
Yeah. These are called non-coding sequences, and they're a bit of a mystery. Some scientists think they might play a role in regulating gene activity, or maybe they have other functions that, you know, that we haven't even discovered yet. It's really quite fascinating.
Fascinating. It's a good reminder that science is never truly finished. There's always more to learn, more to explore, even within, like, the very essence of life itself. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the incredible world of DNA.